And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. We had our scheduled guest, author and anthropologist David Graeber. We've been unable to hook up with him for a live broadcast. He's in London, and we're just not able to reach him. So we have some alternate programming, and Bonnie has the word on that.
We do. Michael Chabon seems unacquainted with failure. His first novel, published when he was only 25, was a bestseller. In 2000, he won the Pulitzer Prize for The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, an epic tale set in the golden age of comics. 5 years ago, he was given science fiction's highest honors for the Yiddish Policeman's Union, a controversial alternate history that spared Europe's Jews the Holocaust by resettling them in Alaska. Now, in his new novel, he takes on the touchy subject of race. Telegraph Avenue follows the co-owners of a vintage record store in Oakland who struggle to stay open in the face of black-white tensions, gentrification, and the ghosts of their past. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Chabon. He began by asking him if a writer can be too exuberant.
How do you mean?
I ask because some critics have wagged their fingers at you for your high-octane prose. Mm-hmm. Part two of your novel, for example, consists of a 12-page-long sentence. Do you ever worry that your style may call too much attention to itself?
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's more, you know, it's a matter of taste. And some reviewers or critics, obviously, you know, my prose style is not to their taste, and that's fine. I wouldn't expect it to please everyone. I think there's plenty of room in the world for a multiplicity of literary styles, and, you know, to criticize me for overwriting, for example, I think is a little bit like criticizing Oscar Peterson for playing too many notes. You know, it's really a matter of taste.
Yeah.
We can't all be Count Basie.
Well, your new novel is named after a real place. Where is Telegraph Avenue?
Telegraph Avenue is a street that runs from downtown Oakland, California, to the campus of the University of California at Berkeley. And it's about 5 miles long, and it changes character a number of times in the course of making that journey. It is one of a number of long, straight boulevards that knit Oakland to Berkeley. And almost like stitches bringing two pieces of fabric together along a fairly ragged seam. And it is really along the seam, although the avenue lends its title to the book, it's really the seam itself that is of interest to me, both as a writer and also as someone who lives on that seam in Berkeley, just on the Berkeley side of the Oakland-Berkeley line.
The plot revolves around the co-owners of a vintage record store, Archie Stallings and Nat Jaffe, if I'm pronouncing those names
yes.
correctly. Tell us about them.
Well, Archie is a veteran of the Gulf War. This book is set in 2004, so it's been a good dozen years since he got home from the war. He is a bass player. He is a native of Oakland. He grew up in the neighborhood that this record store conducts its business. The record store is called Brooklyn Records. He's African-American. He's about 35 years old. He's married. And as far as he has ever conducted his life is concerned, he has no children, although it develops very quickly in the book that he has a son from a brief liaison, a son whose existence he was aware of but whom he never acknowledged. And he's also expecting imminently the birth of his first child with his wife, Gwen. And that fact, along with the economic misfortunes, the ongoing economic misfortunes of his record store, which are about to intensify, those things give him a lot of stress and agita in the course of the novel. His partner, Nat Jaffe, is a transplanted Easterner. He grew up in Richmond, Virginia. He is a white guy, but he was raised in a black part of Richmond with his father married a black woman for his second marriage, so he was raised by a black stepmother. He never finished college. He's very much self-educated. He's a piano player. He's a very tightly wrapped, tightly wound guy by comparison to Archie, who's very loose and very chill. Nat is the opposite of that. And so the two of them complement each other in a number of different ways. They are best friends. They are bandmates in a band called the Wakanda Philharmonic. And they are the co-owners of this little record store, and they have been for about a decade when we first meet them.
Well, we're speaking with novelist Michael Chabon. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Yes.
Whose latest work is entitled Telegraph Avenue. Well, a shadow falls over Archie and Nat in the form of Gilbert Good, an ex-NFL star turned music mogul. He plans to build a mega music store nearby, complete with a section for vintage vinyl.
Right.
It will put Archie and Nat out of business. It's easy to see Gilbert as a villain, Lex Luthor-ish.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't his heart in the right place? Isn't he trying to help the neighborhood?
Very much so, yeah. He is, you know, he's very well-intentioned. He has already built one of these retail extravaganzas. It's actually like a mega mini mall in a way. It's not just a media store, but also has a multiplex and a lot of other retail stores. And he, the one that he built down in LA, he built it in a disadvantaged, largely black part of Los Angeles, hired a lot of local people to work in the store, helped revitalize this area by creating kind of an instant commercial main street in a neighborhood that had been largely destroyed by urban renewal, and you know, has been very successful at doing this, and also has of course gotten a lot of praise for the social agenda that goes hand in hand with his commercial agenda. And now he's come back to Oakland. I say come back because he was in part raised in Oakland, and he wants to do the same thing in a very similar kind of neighborhood here in Oakland, California. He has only good intentions in so doing. I mean, he wants to make money, but this media store of his specializes in African American culture. They specialize in African American books and African American music in the media, in the music department, and film in the video department. And you know, he doesn't want to crush Brooklyn Records. It's not like when certain big box book retailing chains deliberately target a neighborhood that already has a thriving independent bookstore and try to crush it and put it out of business. That's not what he's looking to do. It's just collateral damage as far as he's concerned to his larger agenda. The shadow that falls across Nat and Archie in particular is that it comes out of their very different responses to the imminent arrival of this dog pile store, as it's going to be called, in that for Nat, it purely spells doom and destruction, it must be fought. And he tries to mobilize the neighborhood to resist this dogpile store is coming in. For Archie, as an African-American himself, it's harder for him to be as fully and squarely opposed to it. And he sees the good in it, he sees the appeal in it, and what's more, with the imminent arrival of his child, and with the surprise arrival of his teenage son, he's suddenly confronted with the need to take stock of his life and to look at what he's doing and say, you know, is being the co-owner of a failing used record store sufficient for me at the age of 35, now going to be doubly a father? I have commitments, I have responsibilities. Maybe this is a sign. And, you know, it's simply an evil, nefarious plot that must be averted.
Well, Archie's a fan of Marcus Aurelius. He's mm-hmm. read the Meditations, right. What, 90 times?
Yeah.
So he's a Stoic.
Yeah, it's really the only book he's ever read in a sense, I think. But he has read it many times. Yeah, he's a Stoic. I don't know if he really is a Stoic. He wants to be a Stoic. He wants to come off as a Stoic. That's his aspiration. You know, I think he would probably also be fond of the poem If by Rudyard Kipling, you know, if you can keep your head while those around you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. I mean, that would be another mantra for him. He wants to come off as this unflappable, unrattleable person who takes everything in stride and just does what needs to be done. But, that, you know, I think it's in part, as it is with so many of us men, a pose.
We're speaking with novelist Michael Chabon, whose latest work is Telegraph Avenue. You've included many references to the music and movies of the 1970s. What's so fascinating about that decade?
Well, I mean, I grew up in that decade, so naturally it's going to loom larger in my consciousness than it might in the consciousness of somebody who grew up in the 80s or the 60s or any other decade. But in particular, with this book, it forms an important part of not just the, you know, what you might call the atmospherics or the furnishings of the story, but of the plot of the story itself. And all of the action of the story ultimately is set in motion by a largely forgotten crime of the early 1970s that whose threatened exposure sets in motion all kinds of other machinations, large and small, that end up stitching together all of the characters, but in particular Nat and Archie, the two teenage boys, Archie's hitherto unacknowledged son Titus, Nat Jaffe's son Julie, and almost all of the other minor characters and semi-major characters in the book are caught up in this Black Panther related crime of 1973. And so,
and Archie's father is a ex blaxploitation.
Right, he's a faded
and
star.
That genre,
blaxploitation
you
film.
Cover that fairly well, I because that's a genre that's been forgotten. And yet it
not
had.
Entirely forgotten. Well, I mean, it has stylistically had a number of comebacks over the years, and you know, the soundtrack, some of the music, it was almost routine for blaxploitation films to be terrible but have amazing soundtracks. And so a lot of the music from those films from that era has survived. You know, Curtis Mayfield and James Brown and Isaac Hayes and Roy Ayers and Johnny Pate and many other really great artists of the time made soundtrack albums, scored those movies, and so the music has survived, you know, and the sort of visual memory of those films has survived. But you know, the movies themselves were by and large pretty lousy.
Well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with novelist Michael Chabon. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Chabon, whose latest work is entitled Telegraph Avenue. Michael, you're white and Jewish, but in this novel you try to sound black. Ethnic and racial ventriloquism is not new. William Styron, the descendant of slave owners, wrote The Confessions of Nat Turner, a first-person account of a rebellious slave. John Updike, a WASP, wrote a series of novels featuring Henry Beck, mm-hmm. a fictional Jewish-American mm-hmm. author. But did the thought of assuming an African-American voice ever give you pause?
Well, I mean, as in creating the narration of the book, I mean, I never felt as if I were trying to pretend to be black in shaping the overall narrative of the book and the language that I chose to write the actual sentences of the book. And it's when it comes to, first of all, giving examples of how my black characters talk and through dialogue and reporting the things that they say to each other. And even more importantly, in going into their consciousness and into the minds and hearts of, especially, Archie and his wife, Gwen, who are the two main characters in the book, that is the moment at which, you know, I begin to arrive at the sort of potentially questionable, somewhat anxiety-inducing precincts of what you've called ventriloquism. I mean, it's a, you know, Styron, you take the example of Styron, that caused a lot of controversy at the time when that book came out, and a lot of black critics and writers united to reject not only that particular attempt on the part of a white writer to write from the point of view of a black man. And I think that's really the essential. It's not really the language per se. It's that point of view that is the potentially questionable or even inflammatory locus of all of this. And you know, That I worried about it, certainly. You know, I mean, I recognize that what I was doing in adopting the point of view of a black man and a black woman for two of my primary characters in this book was potentially, you know, tricky, risky, dangerous, questionable, forbidden. There are a lot of adjectives I could have applied to it. You know, I just resolved that I would be as sensitive and careful and as self-conscious about it as I possibly could. And when I say self-conscious, I mean that I would not shy away or try to deny or run and hide from the history of, I think, to put the clearest name on it that you possibly can and to really make it clear what it is we're talking about, the potential for minstrelsy, for blackface. You know, I wasn't going to try to deny that there was that was the danger that I was at risk of falling into in doing this. And, you know, to try to acknowledge that in various ways through the text itself, through the use of blaxploitation as an important motif in the story, through the use of through having a character who's called Moby, who's a big white guy who, quote unquote, talks black and affects kind of his own peculiar ghetto patois that he thinks is a cool way to talk, and through a lot of other ways of signaling to the reader, hopefully, and the reader who's particularly going to be looking for, you know, to bust me on this, that I know what I'm doing is, you know, problematic, and I think it's worth doing anyway. I think it's worse to forbid all writers to sort of prima facie eliminate an entire category of artistic expression. I think that kind of censorship is worse than minstrelsy. It might be, you know, the way you set the scale, for some people it might be 50-50 or 51-49. I think it's more clear than that, but still, I think it's clear that censorship is worse than minstrelsy.
We're speaking with my novice, Michael Chabon, whose latest work is entitled Telegraph Avenue. Your novel, as you pointed out earlier, is set in 2004, presidential election year. On page 158, there is a fundraiser for John Kerry, the Democratic nominee. The guest of honor is then-state Senator Barack Obama. But the scene is told mostly from Obama's point of view. That's cheeky, isn't it?
You know, it probably is, but it didn't feel that way at the time. It just, it felt right, and it felt when you're writing a novel that is set in multiple points of view, that where you have the freedom as a narrator to, you've established the freedom as a narrator to go into the character of anybody in this book, but you have primary point of view characters who are the ones that you return to most frequently for chapter after chapter, there's both a kind of relief, but also a sort of necessary switching of perspective that takes place when you go abruptly into the mind of a lesser character, a minor character. To go into the point of view of a minor character to get a perspective on one of the novel's major characters is both a satisfying thing to do as a writer who's kind of sick and tired of being in the same point of view for chapter after chapter, but also I think for the reader to suddenly get that flipping of perspective and to get a different view on a character, and especially even to get a view of a character who's not also from the point of view of a character who's also not one of the major characters in the book. And so I do this in a number of ways. There are other characters who only essentially get one chapter from their point of view, and it's always a chapter that involves giving you a different kind of perspective on one of the main characters. So, you know, as a technique, it's a standard technique, and it's one that I employ, you know, fairly frequently in this novel. The fact that at the point of view that the minor character into whose point of view I was going in this part was then State Senator Barack Obama, was actually just made it more fun, just made it that much more of a relief for me.
Well, you know the president personally. Your wife, Eilat Waldman, who is also a novelist, was a classmate of Obama's at Harvard Law School. During the 2000 campaign, you both raised money for him.
Yeah, 2008.
In 2008. Mm-hmm. You were there at Chicago's Grand Park on election night.
Right.
You attended the inauguration.
Right.
Later, the two of you did a little nervous act at a White House event. Which
nervous, that's a very kind adjective. Yeah.
And you don't want anybody to see that on YouTube. But
No. that is for sure.
Well, in 2010, Juno Diaz wrote a piece for The New Yorker in which he criticized Obama's storytelling skills.
Mm-hmm.
To be an effective president, Diaz believes, you have to provide the public with a coherent and invigorating narrative. Obama hasn't done that. This has left him vulnerable to the narratives of his enemies, such as the Tea Party. Diaz wrote, quote, "A man cannot withstand a story, even if the man is remarkable and the story is simple. The story always wins."
Mm-hmm.
In other words, either you define your administration or someone else will define mm-hmm. it negatively.
Mm-hmm.
Does Diaz have a point?
Oh, yeah, I totally agreed with that. And I mean, when I read what Juno had written, it echoed thoughts I'd been having a much more, you know, inchoate form myself. Just where is he? Where is he? Why isn't he talking to us anymore? That's a feeling I've had frequently over the past 4 years. You know, every so often he seems to emerge and provide us with an echo of the Obama that we came to know as a fairly masterful storyteller.
He is, and he's a great writer.
And absolutely, and I think more than anything else, that was the initial appeal to me, among so many other things about him that I found so appealing, was simply that he was a really good writer, and you know, he is a really good writer. And I was impressed not simply by his writing ability, his ability to use language in itself, but also by the nuanced perspective on things that seemed to me to be a hallmark of someone who is deliberative, who thinks like a writer, who almost makes it a point of professional pride to be able to see the other side of a question and to see the good and the bad in things. And that impressed me very much. You know, none of us knows what it's like to be inside that bubble. But given the colossal disaster that he immediately found himself in possession of on assuming the office of president, or the night he was elected, and given the sort of, I think, structural institutional pressures on the president of the United States to stay somewhat inside that rose garden, is to stay embattled, to stay inside the bubble like that. You put those two things together, a lot of work to be done, and a pressure to sort of to stay inside. I think the result has been this sort of a sense of that he's vanished a little bit, and that we're not hearing what we need to hear, and that other people have been able to take control of the narrative.
Yeah, because when he said about Bill Clinton that he should appoint him as secretary explaining things,
yes,
I got very mad, because you should be the secretary of explaining things.
Right, right. I mean, that's, yeah, and there's no doubt about it, and I'm not really sure what the explanation is, of course, but it was clear to me. I saw him. I don't know him well. I hasten to say I do not know him at all well, but I saw him right after he had become president, and he was changed. He had been changed by the institution itself.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with novelist Michael Chabon. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Chabon, whose latest work is entitled Telegraph Avenue. Michael, recently I read Kurt Vonnegut's letters. Early in his career, he admitted that it was difficult for him to create well-rounded female characters.
Mm-hmm.
You've been accused of writing boys' books,
mm-hmm.
but women do play a strong role in Telegraph Avenue.
Indeed.
Archie and Nat's wives, for example, who are they and what do they do?
Well, there's Gwen, who I've already talked about a little bit. She is, like Aviva Roth Jaffe, Nat's wife, a nurse midwife, and the two women are in practice together as midwives in Berkeley. And the other principal source of plot and storytelling in the novel, aside from the Black Panther crime-related plot that I was talking about before, and the Gibson Good opening his dog pile in the neighborhood that contains broken records, is the story of a birth, a home birth, that at the beginning of the book, goes wrong, really through no fault at all of the two midwives, but they are called onto the carpet and held accountable for it by the hospital, at which they have privileges. There was certainly all through the 90s in Berkeley and Oakland an ongoing struggle on the part of midwives to hold on to their ability to both assist at home births and to also have privileges at a hospital to have patients at the hospital and to assist at births, at hospital births. And effectively, over the course of the decade from the mid-90s on, that right was taken away from them. And now in Berkeley and in the Bay Area as a whole, you can't do both. If you do home births, you can't do hospital births. The hospitals and insurance companies will not let you. And so that is a struggle that Gwen and Aviva are just, they're caught up in it, in this conflict between hospitals and the right, and the desire of women to give birth at home. And it takes, inevitably, I guess, it, for Gwen, who's Black, it takes on a racial tinge. She gets into an incident with the doctor at the hospital. He calls her, he uses some language, an epithet that are clearly racist in nature, and because of that, it's in a way that's analogous to what happens with Archie and Nat and the threat of Dogpile. It's kind of the reverse situation where Aviva, the senior of the two midwives, one who's known as the Alice Waters of midwives, really just sees it as a clear case of they have to do what it takes to be able to continue to do what they do and not to get all caught up in the politics of it. It's, if it takes an apology, you apologize, you do whatever you need to do because you're there to serve the women, you're there to serve mothers, and that's it, and nothing else matters. For Gwen, it's not that easy. And for Gwen, because she is Black, because she was the one who was insulted, because she is the lone Black nurse midwife practicing midwifery in the entire Bay Area in this novel, she has a lot more at stake, and it feels like a different kind of fight to her. And so this causes a fissure between her and Aviva, much as there is a fissure caused between Nat and Archie over the record store's fate.
Well, I'd like to move on to some of your other books. Your first novel, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, was published in 1988 when you were only 25.
24, actually.
Oh, 24? Really? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's even more disgusting. it was a bestseller. The next 5 years were difficult. You wrote more than 1,000 pages of a novel that wasn't going anywhere.
Right.
Finally, you put it away and worked on something else, a novel about a writer who couldn't finish a 1,000-page novel that isn't going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Wonder Boys, another bestseller. Is this a lesson to writers? Nothing is wasted. Every failure can be turned to your advantage?
It sounds good. I mean, I would like to believe that. I think it's a very American way of thinking of things or looking at things that, every failure can help lay the groundwork for some future success. And that's certainly how I've chosen to see it over the years. I think it is, at the time I was going through it, I was not able to console myself with that thought at all. It was just felt awful, and the thought of having to give up that book after so much work on it was incredibly painful. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. I didn't know that, I think part of the reason that I stuck with it for as long as I did was that I was afraid of what it would mean if I abandoned it, and would it mean I was even to continue with thinking and things in a classically American way, that worst of all things you can be in American culture, a quitter. I didn't want to go there. I didn't want to think that about myself. And so I stuck with that book for as long as I possibly could. But, finally was able to give it up ultimately because of the sudden arrival of 6 weeks of entirely free time where my behavior essentially wasn't going to be accounted for by anyone. And the immediate unexpected arrival of a first sentence The first real writer I ever knew was a man who did all of his work under the name of August Van Zorn, which turned out to be the first sentence of a book, Wonder Boys. And, I don't know where that sentence came from to this day. It just popped out just like that. I wrote it down and I kept going. And 6 weeks later, When this magic period ended, I had 110 pages of what I thought was a good novel going well, and I finished a first draft in 7 months. It wasn't so much that I wanted to sort of take my failure and somehow turn it to my advantage. In fact, the opposite was the case. In creating the character of Grady Tripp, the writer in the book Wonder Boys, I was trying to sort of create almost like a voodoo doll, in a sense, the onto whom I was going to put all of the bad juju that I didn't want to affect me. And in a way, I tried to create a character, and the character of Grady Tripp, who was very unlike me in many respects. He was older than I was, a lot older, although now I'm older than he is. And he was a different kind of writer from a different generation, and he had a very different lifestyle and a very different approach to, you know, relationships and everything. And just to create this character who was not me, and let him be the one who got trapped inside of the book, let him be the one who had all the bad juju on him, and somehow make it clear to myself that I wasn't like that, that I wasn't the kind of guy that was going to be stuck inside a book for year after year after year.
Wonder Boys is partly about competitiveness among writers, mm-hmm. and how it can get nasty, which brings me to an unpleasant subject, one I'm sure you'd rather not talk about.
Oh, great. That sounds fun.
On the evening of November 19th, 2006, Michael, you viciously attacked a fellow novelist at a writer's conference in New England. It was brutal. I didn't know you were capable of such violence. Fortunately, no harm was done because you were two-dimensional at the time. I'm referring, of course, to an episode of The Simpsons.
Right, a word loaf.
Appeared.
Right.
And in that episode, you got into a fight with Jonathan Franzen.
Indeed. I kicked his butt, actually.
Huh?
I kicked his butt.
You kicked his butt. You kicked Franzen's butt. You corrected his behavior. Mm-hmm. You're the first writer I've interviewed who's appeared on The Simpsons. You're probably going to be the last one.
Well, if you have Neil Gaiman. If you ever have Neil Gaiman.
That's true. What was the experience like?
It was fun. I mean, I was and have been a huge fan of The Simpsons for a long time, and I really, leapt at the opportunity to appear, to have that transformation wrought on me, to become yellow and flat and
eight-fingered.
Exactly. But I have to say, in the long run, not that I at all regret the experience, and I really did enjoy it. I actually got to be in the studio with Franzen, and we acted out our fight standing side by side at two microphones, and that was a really fun experience too. But it kind of ruined the show for me, because I saw behind the scenes, I saw Dan Castellaneta and Harry Shearer and all the other talented vocal caricature artists who do the voices for that show. And seeing how it's done, seeing behind the curtain like that, and seeing that Harry Shearer, for example, just sits on a stool, reading the LA Times, and then every so often, leans close to the microphone, and out comes the voice of Mr. Burns or Smithers or whoever it might be, it sort of shattered the illusion permanently for me. And now whenever I do happen to see the show, I turn it on, it's ruined. All I see is some guys sitting around on stools.
Oh, that's too bad.
I know.
Oh, both Mysteries of Pittsburgh and Wonder Boys were turned into movies. Wonder Boys was excellent.
Yes.
It stars Robert Downey Jr. and Tobey Maguire before they became Iron Man and Spider-Man. I tell people it's the movie where Iron Man has sex with Spider-Man because both characters are gay.
I never thought of that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Unfortunately, Wonder Boys bombed at the box office, mm-hmm. so did Mysteries. Yeah. Are you happy with the way Hollywood treats your books?
Well, I mean, Wonder Boys, that was sad because it had so much potential, and it was a big studio release. It was a Paramount release, and it had potentially the full force of a big studio's marketing department behind it, and so it could have done really well. It could have been a big movie because it was good, and it was a major studio release with a great cast and all of that. That was disappointing. Mysteries of Pittsburgh was a little indie film. It was very limited release, and it was never going to be a big blockbuster. That much was clear.
Well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with novelist Michael Chabon. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. I'm Aero Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLON. Our guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Chabon, whose latest work is entitled Telegraph Avenue. In 2000, you won the Pulitzer Prize for The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. This is a loose baggy monster about two comic book artists who create a legendary superhero during the golden age of comics, which encompassed the Great Depression and World War II. Since then, many serious writers have published superhero-themed novels and stories. Jonathan Lethem and Juno Diaz, just to cite two examples. And of course, there are the movies. Billions of dollars have been made from superhero movies such as the Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy, right. The Avengers, Spider-Man, etc. What's with this fascination with what Grant Morrison, the graphic artist, calls masked vigilantes, miraculous mutants, and a sun god from Smallville?
Well, I mean, I think you have to separate out. I'm not sure it's correct to lump all of those things together. The big blockbuster Hollywood films and the novel, say a novel like Fortress of Solitude by Jonathan Lethem, for example. I think in the case of a book like Fortress of Solitude, what you have is a piece of literature written by a great artist who grew up loving comic books and wanting to try to find a way to both account for and incorporate everything that he loved about reading Marvel comic books in the 1970s as a kid in Brooklyn, New York, into a great work of literature. And coming of age as a writer at a time when that has become permissible, and that you're not just automatically going to find yourself kicked to the critical curb for incorporating a form of popular culture that has long been considered to be worthless or subnormal or fit only for children into the texture and weave of a work of literary fiction. With the big blockbuster films that you're talking about, in part there's a certain overlap in that you might have somebody like Jon Favreau, for example, who made the first two Iron Man movies, that the only two that have come out so far, somebody who loved comics, grew up loving them, and found himself commercially in a position where, as a director, he was able to take the helm of a big franchise like that and not only, provide the kind of blockbuster film that's going to put lots of people in lots of theater seats and sell lots of merchandise and candy and Coke, but I think that's not always what's going on with these big blockbuster superhero movies, and that a lot of times, first of all, a lot of the directors who take over those films, who take on those films, are self-confessed to not have known very much about the character before they started making the movie. And also, that's just an example of the big boom in superheroes is an example of bandwagon effect and studios all jumping on the superhero bandwagon because of there have been, a number of big commercial successes. I don't think there's really so much a bandwagon effect taking place in the fiction world after Cavalier and Clay, so much as that, the barrier had already been knocked down a little way for me when I was working on and publishing that book, just a little. And I think Cavalier and Clay knocked that barrier down the rest of the way, or almost the rest of the way, that made it a little easier for somebody like Lethem to contemplate doing that kind of book what he does in Fortress of Solitude, and not worry quite so much about the jeering that might automatically result.
Well, Sherlock Holmes is another popular fictional character, and you've written a Sherlock Holmes novel.
Indeed.
The Final Solution. It's the shortest novel you've written, I think.
Yes, I think so. Although Gentleman in the Road, I have two that are about the same length.
Your Holmes novel, The Final Solution, is set during World War II. Holmes is ancient. He's in his 80s and retired. He meets a strange boy with a parrot. There's a murder. And in the backdrop, he's the 20th century's greatest crime. The title, Final Solution, has a double meaning. It also refers to the Holocaust. Did you get any grief for inserting the Holocaust into a Sherlock Holmes story?
Yes, I did. And I got not just grief over having done that, but I got grief simply over the title itself, which some people found to be in poor taste. And I guess I see the point. I still think it's the right title. I still think it's a good title. You know, it refers very directly to one of the best known Sherlock Holmes stories, the one in which he meets his death.
The final problem.
Right, his apparent death. And so it just felt, you know, perfect. And I still think it is perfect, but I can see why some people, it might induce a cringe or a wince. And, you know, in Germany, for example, when that book was translated, they translated it as Die letzte Rätsel, which I think means the last riddle, because they just didn't want to go there. And I get that.
Well, you also got criticism for your novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. This is an alternate history. You imagine what would have happened if European Jews had been resettled in Alaska during World War II, thus sparing them the brunt of the Holocaust. In this new world, Israel doesn't exist. Similarities were noted between this novel and The Plot Against America by mm-hmm. Philip Roth. Mm-hmm. Another alternate history, which imagines what would have happened if Charles Lindbergh, an anti-Semite and Nazi sympathizer, had defeated Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1940 for the presidency. Since the beginning of his career, Roth has been called a self-hating Jew because he's not afraid to portray Jews realistically. You've also been called a self-hating Jew, you know, by some people. Not as much as Roth, but by a few people.
I don't hate myself as much.
Exactly. Uh-huh. David Mamet, the playwright, would agree. In his screed, The Wicked Son, he says any writer or artist who criticizes Israel or doesn't practice the faith is a self-hating Jew. Uh-huh. I gather you would disagree.
I mean, if that's really what he says, and I haven't read that piece, then I mean, that's just absurd. Like any generalization, it's inherently false. I think the most important thing to say was that in the book, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, I'm not criticizing Israel. I have no intention of criticizing Israel in that book. I was interested in exploring what it would be like to live in a Yiddish-speaking modern world. In a world with ATM machines and cell phones, in which everyone speaks Yiddish, and the local government is a Yiddish-speaking government, and as part of trying to imagine that world into being in a plausible way that was consistent with history, and in fact grows out of an actual historical proposal that was made in 1940 to allow Jewish refugees to settle in Alaska, which was then a territory of the United States, it seemed very unlikely that the state of Israel would have come into existence in that scenario. And in fact, I think early pre-state Zionists would have agreed, and they did agree, because, for example, right after World War II, there was a proposal in Holland, in the parliament in the Netherlands, to create a refuge for Jews in what was then still Dutch Suriname. The Zionists in Israel, and I would use the term Zionists because they're, this was pre-state people who were working very hard to bring into existence the state of Israel, which finally happened in 1948. So this is about 46, I think. They dispatched Golda Meir, who was still called Golda Meirson at the time, who had these impeccable socialist credentials, to go to the directly to the socialist bloc in the Dutch parliament and rally them to defeat this proposal, because they saw it, I think correctly, as meaning if this happened and the world was able to say, well, look, there's Suriname, let's just put all the Jews there, and any Jews that need to go there, want to go there, they can go there, they'll have their place, and forget about this tricky, difficult, Arab-surrounded thing that's going on in the British Mandate right now. That's where I took my cue from history. I did eliminate Israel in that sense, and some people, in responding to that, saw it as an endorsement on my part, as saying, you know, look, the world would be a better place without Israel, or I wish the world didn't have Israel in it. But I think you really have to do a poor job of reading the novel to come to the conclusion that that's how I feel. And I was heartened when there were other reviewers, in particular in the Israeli press, who chose to view the book as a cautionary tale about how terrible the world would be, and how terrible in particular the world would be for Jews if there were no Israel in it. It's not like I present this paradisical place where you know, the world, because it didn't have Israel in it, came out to be this sparkling utopia. It's a dark, grim place.
You put them in Sarah Palin's Alaska.
Yes, I did.
I mean,
indeed.
That's horrible.
That's all. Enough said.
Well, in Telegraph Avenue, Jews and blacks seem to have, you know, harmony with one another.
Well, a Jew and a black.
Well, that's true. And that's not usually the case in Jewish American literature or African American literature. There is this tension sometimes.
Yes. Well, I mean, in the world, there's in the real world, there's, I'm sorry to report, there's unfortunately at this point a fairly long history ever since the late 1960s of tension between the black community and the Jewish community, and it's a heartbreaking thing given the history of those two communities before that point. But, you know, I don't deal in generalities, and I don't deal in, you know, trends or wide social swaths. I'm just talking about two guys, and they love each other.
Well, thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Michael Chabon.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives, directed by Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary produces online. Tomorrow's program is with experts on how to deal with a cancer diagnosis. Whether it's your own plight or a loved one, it creates stress, anxiety, and fear. And, of course, we'll be taking your calls. And to the calendar, on this day in 1933, 80 years ago, the birth of singer and composer Willie Nelson in one of my favorite towns, Abbott, Texas. Crazy to all the girls I've loved before. On the road again. The party's over. And on this day in 1952, 61 years ago, the first TV commercial for a toy appears. Everyone had one. Hasbro's Mr. Potato Head. One more before we clean house. On this day in 1973, 40 years ago, President Nixon announces the resignations of top aides Bob Haldeman, John Ehrlichman, and Attorney General Richard Kleindienst, plus the firing of Chief Counsel John Dean. We leave with a thought from the 37th president, quote, "It's a piece of cake until you get to the top. You find you can't stop playing the game the way you've always done." Joseph Cooper here for Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.